Dr. Catarino?
Present, finally.
Dr. DiBacco?
Present.
Dr. Robbins?
Present.
Dr. Bohan?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Dr. Ostrom?
Present.
And Dr. Yoon?
I'm sorry, I didn't know he was muted. I'm here, present.
Very good. And if I mispronounce anyone's name, please let me know. But we have perfect attendance, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Does anyone have any? Well, first, I want to welcome the new members for coming and thank you for being willing to participate in this. I did want to look at point three. Some of you were not here, but there was one correction I wanted to make to the minutes of February 4th, our previous meeting. And it was just that I, for me, on page one, it said I was the chair of a joint clinical and school psych program. I was just the chair of school psych, but I taught in the clinical program. Does anyone else have any corrections to the minutes? Yeah.
Madam Chair, I made a correction previously. The initial minutes indicated that I was the first combined professional, combined practitioner, scientific practitioner. I wasn't the only one. I was one of the first in the state of Arizona. And that was corrected already.
Anybody else have a comment? Okay, so that I move that we approve the minutes if we're all in agreement. Everyone say aye if you agree.
You need a second, and some of us cannot vote on it because we were not present.
Right, those that were present.
Second.
So, Jolene and...
And I, that's fine. Yeah, I approve.
Okay. All right, then I think that there's a brief introduction. You did give your names, but you might want to say, you know, in your role and how you see yourself on this committee and why you were selected, maybe. So I'll start with Dr. DiBacco, who was one of the first joint clinical school people for the state of Arizona.
Right. Thanks, Linda. Yeah, way back when, I actually was in a program, was one of the first combined programs. And I was trained in school and clinical psychology. And I've operated in both contexts most of my career. My primary work over the last few years has been with the Department of Child Safety. But in any case, Linda, you requested I be on the committee, and I'm flattered that you would ask me. And for those of you who don't know, I served on the board for 5 years from 2010 to 2015, and this issue has come up before. So again, I was flattered when you invited me, and I saw it as an opportunity to maybe pick up on that conversation that started, I think, back in 2013, 14, something like that.
Yes, I thought, you know, not only because I respect your work, but you would have the historical background to help us. Jolene?
Hi, I'm Jolene Robbins, and I am the past president of the Arizona Association of School Psychologists, and I'm retired now, but my last job was as lead psychologist for Gilbert Schools. And I've been licensed in a couple of other states and had private practices in those states, but have only worked as a school psychologist technically for a district here, outside of a small amount of private practice, I guess, since being here in Arizona in 2000. I think Linda and I chatted about this, and I got included perhaps because I was a consumer of the IEE question. And as a lead psychologist, IEEs were typically sent to the lead psychologists for translation to people and sharing information and trying to be that liaison between the practitioner who had done the IEE and the school team. So I've kind of seen the gamut of excellent IEE reports and ones that were nearly useless to the public schools and in illuminating a case for a family in a district. And so, you know, And interestingly, in my perspective, licensure wasn't necessarily what made that those reports good. But I think the question to come up about who can do this independent work and who should be doing this independent work is timely. I think we're seeing more and more flexibility in practice, and we just want to make sure we're doing what we think is right ethically, I think, for the kids of Arizona. So that's why I think I'm here.
Well, you're also here because I respected your work. I nominated you for the Lifetime Achievement Award, and you won it from the Arizona Association of School Psychologists. Yeah. You've been, your district has shown a lot of good work in psychology and special education, and you also are licensed and have experience on both sides. So I thought you would be a very good match. And Dr. Malott.
Yeah, hi, I'm Dr. Malott, and I'm a long-term board member. So I do have a history, you know, I bring that history as well. I think some of you have spoken on this issue. This is my 16th year actually starting on this board. But look at Jean, she thinks I'm crazy. She just walk away. So
no, I'm not
crazy.
I keep waiting for a replacement. I'm on overtime. So. But it doesn't seem to be happening. But I'm always, I enjoy my time on the board. And we actually do have a combined program at NEU. You know, I'm the academic member. So the board always has two academic members. And I serve as one of the two academic members on the board. So I bring that academic perspective. I also bring a Northern Arizona perspective, which is a unique perspective, I think, because we are bordering very rural areas of the state, and we have a strong need to serve rural Arizona, you know, and many of our practitioners travel many miles, and my husband is included. So in terms of disclosure, he's a school psychologist. Licensed schools, you know, licensed by this board, but travels, you know, three times a week, except during this pandemic, to different schools on the reservation providing services in areas that are not served. There are no school psychologists throughout Northern Arizona that are full-time in practice. And so I say that because that is a big, whatever we do, we have to continue to serve our rural populations. And we have to keep that in mind. You know, when you live in an urban area, it's really hard to understand sometimes. Dr. Bohansky was a very big advocate of the distant areas of the state. And so so that's why I share that perspective. So whatever we do, I do not want to hurt whatever services we can provide in rural Arizona. And as you know, reservation schools, I cannot think of any school psychologist full-time. Maybe Kathy knows some, but almost all of them are contract psychologists. They travel out there to provide services in schools. But by training, I'm not a school psychologist, though I'm very familiar with the program, having been a department chair and a faculty member with colleagues like Dr. Bowen, who's also on this committee, and worked a lot with our students and have some awareness of the needs. So, thanks.
Thank you. Well, since we'll stay with Northern Arizona connection, Dr. Bohan, would you want to suggest why you might be here and what you hope to bring to the committee?
Sure. Thank you, Linda. And I believe I'm on the committee. I'm the president-elect for the Arizona Association of School Psychologists. So I'll be coming in as president as of July 1st. I've been a school psychologist for about 25 years and have been with Northern Arizona University for 20 years and have served as both a faculty member as well as the chair of the department, coordinator for the school psychology program, and associate dean for the College of Education. I am licensed by this board and also certified as a school psychologist nationally for NCSP. I guess I'd concur with Ramona too, as far as conversations around this, representing all of the school districts and students in Arizona, especially those in rural areas and on the reservation. I do know of a few school psychologists who are full-time in some districts. For instance, Window Rock and Chinle, and I think Tuba City do have full-time school psychologist, but most all of the other smaller communities in rural Arizona are using itinerant school psychologists. So certainly want to represent that perspective in this committee.
Thank you. Dr. Yoon, is that how I pronounce your name? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gina Yoon. I am currently the program director of school psych program at the University of Arizona. I was trained as a school psychologist, and I had a specialty in child clinical. So I did a postdoctoral fellowship in child clinical in Texas, and have been teaching, have been a trainer. I spent 16 years at Wayne State University, Detroit, Michigan, while I maintained private practice there. And then I got here as the training director in 2015, so relatively newer to the state of Arizona, but I do have a license by the board. And I guess I was invited to provide perspectives from trainers from the program perspective. We do have EDS program in Chandler and Tucson, as well as PhD program in Tucson. So hope that I can support this committee.
Thank you. And Dr. Ostrom.
Hello, I am trained as a school psychologist, and I am currently serving on the Arizona Association of School Psychologists board as the ADE liaison. So I think that's kind of my role, is to provide a little bit of that input. I am also a licensed psychologist, and I serve currently in the Tempe Elementary School District as a social behavioral health coordinator, which supervises school psychologists.
Right. And for those of you that don't know, in the bottom is a saguaro cactus. And then Jean, you might want to introduce yourself. I'm not sure they know your role.
Good afternoon. My name is Jean Galvin, and I am an assistant attorney general, and I'm legal counsel to the board of psychologist examiners. I've served in that role for approximately 12 years, and I'm happy to serve the committee any way that I can.
Thank you. And Jennifer?
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Michelson. I am the deputy director here for the board, and I primarily handle the investigations for the agency.
And Heidi, do they know your actual role? I don't know.
Yes, Madam Chair, I serve the board and all of its committees and task forces and all of its moving parts as the executive director. And I'm not new to regulation. I've worked in that capacity for some 20 years, relatively new to psychology. I believe this is about 17 months with this board. So I'm happy to take your direction and organize your meetings and assemble your research, whatever you need to do your work.
Yeah, I just want to thank also the members of, Ms. Packerman, Ms. Galvin, and Ms. Michelson. They provided us with a lot of resources and have really helped in organizing this committee. And actually, this committee was organized at the request of Ms. Packerman. During one of the meetings, I had some comments about school psychology and licensure, and they said, well, why don't you organize the committee? And so that's where we are. So the purpose of the committee, there's several things. This is point five on our agenda. And as I'm going along, I'm finding more purposes. So one of the things is as we look at the history, which I'll go over, one of the things are, there have been school psychologists in the past who have conducted private evaluations, and members of the board have been concerned that they do not have a license. They're using terms such as psychological or neuropsychological in their work. And these are terms that the board has assumed to be protected as these services are only provided outside of the schools by licensed psychologists. So one of them is to look at the role of non-licensed school psychologists. Another goal, I believe, is the role of these contracting agencies that provide contracts school psychologists for districts. Another role would be to look at what do we do if people are using these terms or functioning in an independent role what are some consequences? How can we handle this? And another role might be, do we need to change or look at our statutes and see, are they in alignment with what the state of Arizona wants? And I also sent out, just unfortunately, I didn't get it done till yesterday, a list of NASP's listing of every other state. Is our law in accordance with the rest of the nation? And do we need to make some changes? So this is why we sent you some of those materials. I'm open if any of you have another. And then independent educational evaluations was another option. Like, do we, you know, what are the qualifications of these independent educational evaluators and what role do they serve? So let me ask the committee if they have any other purposes they would like to cover that I didn't list. Okay. So, no, we asked the committee, we'll go on to point six of the history. I asked the administration here to figure out if there have been other times when school psychology has been mentioned in recent years. And they did have, they gave us minutes, which I don't know if you've all had time to look at, but they gave us minutes starting from May 3rd, 2013. And there was, I'll just read, because there was just a point on that one on page six. And there was a point 12 where Dr. Wexler, the previous chair, said it is unclear what the scope of practice for a school psychologist entails. He elaborated that he understands school psychologists who are not licensed by this board can only provide services within the school setting. So this is one point where it's been referred to. Now, I would say that this probably refers to the Model Licensing Act. If you have a copy of that on page 11, they do give an exemption for school psychologists to provide services in the schools, only under the purview of the state education agency. And they can be called school psychologists, but not psychologists unless they're licensed also. So then we had just a brief correction on October 4th, which I don't think is worth mentioning. December 13th, again, they had, let's look at the exemptions for licensure. And they talk about the Model Licensure Act and this exemption. But it says the board has become aware that some certified school psychologists who are not licensed by the board are providing services outside the school setting. So this, they mentioned that this is a, this was actually a letter, December 2nd, 2013. This was a letter to the then president, Mr. Rick Dwyer, president of ASP. And they listed also the violations for somebody engaging in the practice of psychology independently of the schools, listing fines and a lot, many consequences. So then Dr. Olvey, who was the executive director prior to Ms. Bachmann, wrote a letter January of 2014 and said, she wrote a letter to him when February 4th, I'm sorry. And she talked about this issue about are people working outside of the schools. On January, the general counsel, Mr. Pickerell for the Mesa district, talked about the school psychologists are employees, but sometimes with a sudden or temporary need, they do hire services of independent contractors. So then we had a letter from the Udall Shumway, and this was from Kimberly Davis, who said that school psychologists may be employed by the district, but sometimes they also would hire contract people, particularly if they have an expertise, maybe, in certain skills like working with the deaf or neuro. But usually they would hire only certified school psychologists who are employed by the district and working in the district. And then we had a question here they would like asked to explain. Can a school psychologist work for more than one district or charter school at the same time? county school psychologist who works as a work as an independent contractor for a district. I didn't see they asked for a response. I didn't know if there was a response to that. Heidi, do you know if there was any response to that Kimberly Davis letter?
Madam Chair, I could find no such response.
That's what I thought. So those are still two outstanding questions. So Dr. Robbins or Dr. Ostrom or any of you, or Dr. Bohan, all from ASP, you know if there was a response? Oh, Julene, I can't hear.
I didn't see a response made by them.
Okay, so that's still, we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, then we had another quickly on February 7th. It was 2014. There was another question about referring to these letters back and forth, and more questions about school psychologists. And another response from Denise Lowell Britt, who's a well-known educational lawyer. And then February 27, 2015, again, it came up. And then finally, we had a recent case that's not on here. When I first joined the board, about a school psychologist that was doing independent evaluations but is not licensed. So this is the history, and this is why, you know, this is why we're part of the reasons why we're having the committee.
Dr. Katarina.
Yes.
Just a point of information. I was the chair of the board during that 2/27/15 meeting.
Yes.
It was item 18 on the board agenda. And I actually raised that issue, and I was one of the psychologists that advised to form an ad hoc committee. And quite frankly, I was concerned that there was no representation from the school psychology community, and I advocated for them being involved. But as far as I know, after that, we agreed to form the committee, and I don't think anything happened after that. I don't think the committee was formed, nor was any further action.
Yes, I didn't emphasize that. I did read that, and I think it was very important that you asked for school psychologists to be on that committee. And then I guess they've been waiting for like 6-7 years now for me to get on the board so we can have this committee. I don't know. Anybody else? Dr. Malott, do you have any other history that you would like to add?
I think a couple of times, every time we received a letter, it's my recollection that members of ASP or the school districts attended a board meeting. And so while you may not see a response in writing, I believe those issues were discussed, because I do remember several different meetings over the years where we had a dialogue with members of the school site committee.
Would these have been in the minutes or someplace?
It finally should have been if they attended a meeting, you know. And I think in my recollection, as a result of all of the different discussion, is that, you know, as long as, regardless of how they're being paid, whether they're full employees with benefits or they're contract employees, they have to be, you know, working within a district, providing psychological services. I am not recalling, and that could be just the independent IEE, which is like a one-time kind of evaluation. But many, as I said, in Northern Arizona, almost all of the schools on the reservation employ contracting psychologists, school psychologists who are certified or licensed psychologists, you know, but they are working within a school district. I mean, within a school. Sometimes they're independent schools, not districts. So
let me ask you that, when you're saying they're having independent IEEs, would they be working in a school district?
No. These are, Second Mesa Elementary School does not have a school psychologist, yet they have referral So they could be contracting with somebody who goes there twice a week and they're paid by the evaluation, you know, or they're paid a daily rate and they receive a 1099 for providing the evaluation that goes on in school districts if, you know, parent wants this child to be assessed. And they meet with they attend the IEP meetings, the MD, the whatever meetings, you know, all the different meetings, and provide that evaluation. I'm not as familiar with the IEE, partly because I'm not a school psychologist. And I think that's a slightly different process.
Right. Okay. Anybody else have any information about the history they'd like to bring up then?
This may be premature, but one of the sticking points I saw back then and now is that the exemption statute talks about employees' employment. It doesn't talk about contract. And if you look at 32-20075, employee is mentioned or a form of it five times, but there's nothing in there about contract. And then Ramona, I think you articulated they're contracted employees, a 1099. They're contracted individuals, contracted psychologists. They're not employees. That would be a W-2. And that's something that I brought up previously. And maybe this is premature, but what I see, quite frankly, is a disconnection in terms of the demand, the common practice, what our statute says. They don't line up. The statute does not talk about an exemption for a contracted psychologist, school psychologist. It does not.
So yeah, I think I'm going to hold on to that. I think that is a little bit premature, but it's a very important point. And when we look at the list I made of all the other states, many of them refer specifically to we will not allow psychologists to practice independently, but we will allow contracting agencies. So they do, some states actually state that. And so this might be that we need to come to a decision and look at our law and should it be changed or not. So that's one of the things. It is a common practice. And I at first was, I did go to Second Mesa and do evaluations in graduate school, but I've had some concerns that by doing that, you don't know the full environment of the school. You're not able to look at all the situations that the child endures. So I think there could be some impact on doing best evaluation possible. But on the other hand, I know there are shortages. So that's something we have to look at, I think, specifically. What do we think about these contract employees? And does our law cover it or not? Which, according to what you have found, it does not. Right.
Well, I think, I would like, Doctor, I think we need to, at some point, maybe get a legal definition of the word employed. You know, what does employed mean? They're still being paid by the school district. I think we would need to ask what that word means.
Yeah. I agree with Dr. Malott. Basically, the IRS will determine in some ways if you're a contracted employee, you're a contractor or an employee, they designate that. I mean, I'm reducing it, quite a bit.
Maybe the IRS, they prefer no contract. Believe me, I file taxes under that, and it's hard to prove you're not contracted. It's hard to prove you're contracted. They prefer.
No, what I'm getting at, I'm not being terribly articulate, is that how does the IRS see the activity of the school psychologist who provides whatever service? How are they filing that? I mean, that's kind of a stilted way of looking at it, but I think it's important. I mean, if the IRS says, no, you're an employee or you're a contractor, and in fairness, I've read stuff that they're not even sure sometimes. So I think that's something that needs to be clarified. I'm not sure who exactly should do it finally. Ultimately, it's our board, your board, who's going to decide. But like I said before, there's no language in the statute, the exemption statute, as it reads, for a contractor. There's none.
And it is, I see your point, because a W-2 form, you're an employee, you get benefits, and you get, and 1099, you're just, this is what I get from insurance companies. You know, I don't get any benefits from them when I do psychological services. I'm an independent person, independent contractor. So let me, we'll hold that, though. That is something we want to bring up. John, I think you might be good now. Do you have that law in front of you? Would you be able to read it for all of us?
The exemption from licensure?
Yes.
Yeah, I can do that. And it's 32-2075. Item A, this chapter does not limit the activities, services, and use of the title by the following. Number one, school psychologist. Number one, employed in a common school, high school, charter school setting, and certified to use that title by the Department of Education. If the services or activities are part of the duties of that person's common school, high school, or charter school employment. Two, twice has been mentioned, employed employment. Number two, an employee of a government agency in a subdoctorate position who uses the word assistant or associate after the title and is supervised by a doctorate position employee. And, you know, I'm going to stop for a second. That would directly impact these independent agencies that are employing school psychologists, but I'll go on. Who is licensed as a psychologist, including a temporary license. Number three, a student of psychology pursuing an official course of graduate study at an educational institution accredited as provided in section 32-2001. If after the title, the word trainee, intern, extern appears, and the student uses the title only in conjunction with activities and services that are part of that program. Number four, a person who resides outside of the state who is currently licensed or certified to practice psychology at an independent level, it goes on. They can practice, and I think it's 20 days defined as an 8-hour day.
Yes.
Okay.
So I don't know. There's a question on that. But I'm wondering, is that all that relates to the school psychology? We covered most of that.
Well, there's the last part. A person in the employ of Arizona State University, Northern Arizona University, University of Arizona, or another regionally accredited university in a state or other institution. It goes on, apparently, if you're in the employ of a state university, you can use the title. It's an exception. But I think, obviously, 1, 2, and 3 definitely apply. And again, my point is that in the statute as it exists, there's no a school psychologist employed and or contracted. That language isn't there. Mm-hmm. It's employee. And it's a legitimate question, and Ramona raised it. You know, how do you define who's an employee and who's a contracted provider? Seems like it'd be simple, but it's more than that. But again, I'm gonna stop talking here in a second, but I don't want to lose sight about the demand. There's a real need out there for school psychologists. There's a shortage, and we need to pay attention to that. So I'll stop there.
Okay. So yes. I wanted to make the point, even the words employed in or employed by a school district are very different. And I sent up a little handout also from just the few states that I had from Heidi's research. I was going to ask Jean, does that make a difference if they employed in a school district or employed by the school district? Do you have any idea, Jean, on that? Hello?
There, I'm off mute. You have to assume under principles of statutory construction that each word or phrase has meaning. So if the legislature talked about employed by or employed in the district, then that would, you could differentiate that by saying that a school district, you can be employed, you know, in the district where you're in their brick and mortar, or you could be employed by them and, you know, maybe on the outside, you know, conducting something like an independent evaluation. Mm-hmm. I haven't researched it specifically to that provision, but you could make a distinction.
I noticed that in looking at the different laws, and I thought there might be a difference. But maybe we need to just look into that a little more if you have a chance.
Yes, and when this issue came up in like 2013, I recall doing a memo to the board about employed by an employee versus an independent contractor. And I'm having someone search for that memo now. I recall doing it, but we'll see if I can find it. Heidi obviously didn't come across it.
Okay, well, thank you. Now, I think what I'd like to go on to point 7, because we're not going to, I'm tabling your points, John, right now, because I think we'll come back to it. But anybody have any else comments they want to make on point 6 on our agenda? Okay, so let's look at point 7. And this has come up. So first we have to know, can you call yourself a psychologist? But then we need to know, can you perform functions as a psychologist? So, you know, we've seen sometimes, maybe you have, where people are life coaches, but they say, if they use the word psychological or something that's really distinct to the field, that might be a violation. So what if a school psychologist uses that has a private office? For example, they may have a private office and then do evaluations, but do it at the school site. But they have their own office, but they'll go to a school and then maybe a charter school. And then they say that they advertise on their website, I'm doing psychological evaluations, neuropsychological evaluations, and psychoeducational evaluations. And I am certified by the State Department of Education. So these people would be non-licensed. Would that, for example, be a violation? How would you all feel about that? So are those terms, I believe that those terms, psychological and neuropsychological, are protected by the, you know, are license protected?
The law is pretty clear, you know, I mean, again, the word employed in, you know, how do we define the word employed, that needs to be addressed. But the law is pretty clear that the work needs to be happening in a school. So setting up a private practice and doing psychological evaluations in your practice, you know, in your practice. And I think we also need to be careful right now because of the pandemic. Some of the schools are not allowing like even contracting psychologists to enter the building, more for safety reasons rather than that. So some of them may need to happen outside the building, you know, but that's not necessarily a private practice.
That's on the school grounds.
Not necessarily.
Oh.
Because of the pandemic, you know, in fact, I was asked to provide space for somebody, you know, just because they're not in private practice, so they don't have an office, but they cannot go into a school. I mean, it's complicated. So we should put the pandemic aside. You know, this is a very short term. So because they're not allowing outside personnel, you know, in schools and things like that. I mean, the reservation has, if you're not a registered member of a tribe, you're not even allowed to enter the reservation, forget a school. So there's more complications like that that are occurring because of the pandemic. But I go there, you know, because hopefully this is a short-term problem.
Yeah, on this point, 7, what I meant by this is using those psychological protective terms.
Yes. And I think those are protected. And I mean, I don't think people you know, that's why we have the cease and desist rules and laws, you know, if somebody is calling, putting themselves out to the public as a private practitioner.
So this Jean, are you with us or not? If you're not, are you? I just wondered, are those terms, is there, maybe for the committee, is there in the statute something about using those terms?
Yes,
there is. That would prohibit an unlicensed person to use terms like, you know, psychologist or psychotherapist, anything with the root word psycho. You're not able to use unless you are licensed. And then I think you have to look at the scope of practice. If someone who is unlicensed, can they administer or conduct those types of evaluations and testing?
What about the word psychoeducational?
I think you guys would probably know better than I am. I would certainly think that that would fall within the scope of a certified school psychologist.
I would think so, but it does have that root psycho is why I questioned it.
Yeah, but clearly a psychoeducational within the school district would seem appropriate.
Okay, and then, you know, just one other point here from the Arizona Department of Ed. So this says that people can, what professionals can conduct appropriate evaluations. And this, at the end, it says this is only within a school. But they do say that school psychologists can conduct evaluations for emotional disability or other things that usually a psychologist would do. But I think we have to make this clear. I don't want anyone to use the Department of Ed paperwork and say, oh, it said I can do an evaluation for emotional disability, you know, which is usually a psychologist.
Within the conversation of what school psychologists do, we certainly do psychological evaluations. We have certain people with expertise and can do neuropsychological evaluations, and we certainly do counseling and therapy. So I'd hate to take all of that vocabulary out of the rubric of school psychology too, because we do that, but we do it in the practice in the school. So that is it. So I'd hate to protect the language to the degree that we wouldn't be included, because of course we do that.
But, you know, when I was in the school district, we had to say psychoeducational evaluation.
I don't think that's necessarily.
No, I don't think
necessarily true.
I agree with Jolie. I think there are plenty of school psychologists who are well-trained and capable of doing this work in school. And I think the key issue here is whether it's a school setting or non-school setting. And the other issue is whether, even if they're licensed, I've seen a lot of people who are licensed, but they don't have a competency in neuropsych eval, and they're doing it and calling themselves neuropsych. I think that's another layer of problems unrelated to this. So to me, that's the two questions is a setting, the issue of setting, and then the level of competency. I think that's
so we have the title, we have the terms, and then we have the location services. Mm-hmm. So those are all things that maybe if we do propose a policy statement or a statute that we need to look at. Okay. But, you know, there are people that have gone through that neuropsych program in Texas, and they are neuropsych, you know, school psychologists, but they may have, you know, the Houston model for neuropsychologists is that you have a doctorate in psychology and then a 2-year postdoctorate in neuropsych. So a person that's gone through that program that has an EDS doesn't have the same training. Yet they, if you're saying that they can use the term neuropsychologist in the school without a license, I am concerned about that.
Yeah, I don't know that I've heard school psychologists refer to themselves as neuropsychs. What I'm
ones that go to that program sometimes do.
Do they? Okay. I just am agreeing too with Gina in that we've got some individuals who have had some pretty specific neuropsych training and are able to do evaluations for us that have that component. And we also contract out sometimes if our staff doesn't happen to have that expertise. And so the school district itself will pay for a neuropsych eval from a privately licensed psychologist. And so we'll do that as well. Yeah. So I'm just saying, I don't know, the terminology, limiting the terminology of what we're doing is of greater concern to me than limiting what we are called. I think certified school psychologists can certainly be called school psychologists, and psychologists that are licensed can certainly be called psychologists. And I'm sure fine with that delineation, but I'd hate to protect all these terms of what we do, because some of us are trained to do multiple things.
But I do think that they are already, it is already protected. That's why I asked Dr. Galvin. I think those terms are already protected.
Except
Ms. Galvin.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ms. Galvin.
But unless you're under that exemption in the school setting.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is, even the term has the exemption.
Yes.
That's what I wanted to make, the title of the person as well as the services.
Correct? I think the biggest concern is all of those services that, Julian just talked about, and as long as they are in the employed, as long as they are employed in the schools, not by the schools, but in the schools, then they can do counseling, they can do psychological evaluations, they can do psychoeducational evaluation. I think the biggest concern I am hearing is, how do you define the word employed? And does a contracted employee fall under the definition of employed in the schools? And we really need to put that to rest, because that's the same discussion we've had for the last 10 years.
Right.
That's
one point, but this point 6-7 is the services point. That's why I wanted to just.
Well, the services, once you define the employee, the services then come under the exemption. So
I have concerns that these evaluations that are done in a school should be called maybe psychoeducational, not neuropsychological, and not psychological.
I have, because they're doing emotional disabilities, and our students are well trained to do emotional disability evaluations.
I'm not saying they're not competent and they can't do it, but the title is what I'm saying. They could do it, but because it's in a school setting, I think it should have educational on it. Because we're looking at, give the example of this, of children with autism. Somebody could say this child has autism, but they don't receive special education services unless it impacts their education. So you have to not only look at their psychological diagnosis, but their educational impacts. That's why I'm saying psychoeducational would be more appropriate.
Well, I think school psychologists have the exemption under the Arizona Department of Education. They are certified by that board to provide these psychological services, including counseling assessment. If we are going to dictate, I think we need to be really careful that you have to call or report this, a district, each district, I don't know. I'm not a school psychologist, so I let the school psychologist speak, but I want us to be careful, so.
Yes, Dr. Caterina?
Yes, John.
I agree with Dr. Magat. There's a regulatory agency for school psychologists, and they have disciplined school psychologists, for incompetency or operating outside of their scope and all of that. And we've talked about this before. I'm not sure the board would want to take on another group to regulate when you don't really need to. I think the issue for me is the certified school psychologist holding themselves out, and is the public perception that they're an independent practice? And I don't have an answer to this, but let's say I'm a school psychologist and I have my own office, but I work in the Mesa School District. Is that different than if I'm employed by the Mesa School District? I don't think I have to necessarily have my office there, if that makes any sense. But again, it comes down to, and Dr. Malott, I think you nailed it, how is that person defined in terms of payment, benefits, et cetera, et cetera? Because that's the language. If the person is employed, I don't think there's a problem. On the other hand, if they're contracting with, and quite frankly, no disrespect to y'all, I don't get the difference in terms of working in a school, employed in a school, and employed by the school. Well, I don't see the distinction.
Well, that's a Ms. Galvin. It's thanks.
Yeah, I know. I may have been her, but I don't see it. An employee is an employee is an employee. And again, for me, it's aligning the demand, common practice, and the common practice is that there's a lot of that going on, apparently, expertise in the statute. I mean, I'm not for or against any of it, but I'm concerned if there's going to be, and I'm not, you know, trying to be snide about this, if there's going to be selective enforcement of the statute. I think that's really dangerous.
We'll get to that. I'm just trying to keep on point seven for now.
Okay.
And so point seven was the terms. And the reason why I questioned it is like, if you had, I'm saying, you know, like a life coach and who uses the word psychological, there are questions about. And so are we saying that when we would, this, the consensus I'm hearing now is that if they can use even neuropsychological, which you're thinking, maybe we could take a vote on this, that is allowed to be used in the school by a non-licensed school psychologist. Is that what you all think?
May I say something?
Yes, please.
My experience is limited, but I have not seen school-based evaluation titled neuropsych.
I haven't either.
I have not seen that kind of, you know, reports at this point in my career. So what I'm thinking is a lot of people may use neurological approach and try to better understand what's going on and not necessarily calling it as a neuropsychologist or neuropsychological evaluations. And I think we have to honor that because that's a good practice.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm talking just about the language though. We want to get it in front of that maybe. Maybe I think there's going to be more people with this Miller's school in Texas that are going to say neuropsych in the future. So I'm trying to get ahead of it, even though we haven't seen that. Dr. Eunice, not completed.
That's okay. The other comment I want to make is the distinction between psychoeducational versus psychological. To me, it's not really that helpful. A lot of times in school, we do different things, and making a distinction because we're doing it in school and we call it psychoeducational and not call it psychological, I think that's not a really useful distinction. We do psychoeducational assessments, and a lot of times we do psychological assessments as well. So because it's happening in school and college psychoeducational, I don't know if I would agree with that approach. We're using a lot of psychological testing, psychological approaches, understanding test, you know, test measurement, all those psychometrics and things like that to actually better understand the child's functioning, whether it's educational or social emotional functioning, right? So I really hope that we don't really tie, you know, debate about the what to call our services in school, because I think we are all doing it, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and I think there's a difference in terms of holding yourself out as a neuropsychologist to the public and do neuropsychological testing. And the reality is that school psychologists were the original neuropsychologists. They were doing auditory discrimination, visual motor integration, processing way back when.
Yes.
They were making remediation recommendations. And I can tell you, I've seen some of these neuropsychs. I would stick with the school psychologist evaluation for the learning disability rather than the neuropsych to describe what was going on. But okay, I'll get off of that.
Yeah, I agree. They were the first neuropsychologists, but I am just saying that this may not have been in effect yet, but it's sort of misleading to the public, I think, to say, you know, if they in the school titled it, and it may happen, even though it hasn't happened, we could prevent it if we wanted to. And the other reason why I was concerned about psychological is because it's psychological within the context of the educational system and how their psychological or neuropsych issues impact their school. Because my understanding is if they don't have an impact, they may not receive special ed services. So you're always looking for that connection between their psychological functioning and the educational impact.
I just wanted to add, I completely agree with Dr. Yoon and Dr. DeBacco. In our district, all of our psychological evaluations are put in a report that is titled with the name of the school district. So it is very clear that it is conducted within the setting of schools. And I think by trying to regulate exactly what terms are used, that it really doesn't make any sense because that information is very similar across settings.
Okay, so that's what, so we sort of have a consensus that everyone thinks that's okay. And we think that for psychological, psychoeducational, and for neuropsych, or not?
What no, about I haven't heard any support for calling an evaluation a neuropsychological evaluation if somebody's not a neuropsychologist. However, there may be neurological assessments done within that psychological evaluation.
Right.
Which is a very different thing than calling it a neuropsychological evaluation. I mean, that to me,
I agree. Yes,
is a problem for even psychologists outside of school. They shouldn't be calling it a neuropsychological if they're not certified.
Unless they were trained before 1985.
Yeah. So we may want to address that as a board in general. You know, people who are putting themselves as a neuropsychologist should have the appropriate training, but that is more for the board, not for this district.
Okay. So for 7, we'll say that they can use any of these terms. Is that correct? Or are we still exempting the word neuropsych about? I'm not sure. I can't.
I don't know. Consensus. Is not a term that is part of this.
I have seen school psychologists say that they conduct and they title the reports neuropsychological. I just want to be sure. I'm either going to have it written up in our minutes that we approve that you can use any of these terms, or we are exempting.
But we don't allow neuropsych terms being used even by, if like myself, I'm a psychologist. I cannot use that term because I don't feel I have the proper credentials to do a neuropsych.
That's because you're ethical.
No. So then, regardless whether you're a psychologist or you're a certified school psychologist, you fall under that same umbrella. Mm-hmm. So
I'm going to ask Ms. Galvin again, is there something that, do we have anything that a neuropsychologist has to have a certain training in our statutes? It's accepted. I know this is how people in the professions view it, but is it a regulatory situation?
I would think that there's something in the ethical code about practicing within your scope of competency. And I just don't know if this is getting too far afield of what the committee was.
Well, there's a reason why I wanted to bring this up. And then I'm going to move on, but there's nothing there specific. Okay, so now I want to go to number 8. This says, what about a non-licensed school? Certified school psychologists conducting independent educational evaluations. So when we had spoken earlier, Jolene, you said that the people that you contracted with all were licensed to do, who had done the IEEs.
In our district, and I checked with a couple of other lead psychologists that were colleagues of mine at the time, and our districts are asked to compile a list of individuals that we can recommend to a family. And we only put people with licenses on that list. Now, the IEE process itself can get muddy. The school district, technically, here's that employment issue again. The school district will pay for an IEE that is conducted by hopefully a licensed person. But once in a while, in the process of whether or not we're going to request an IEE, the district decides that, in fact, they don't believe that the family deserves an IEE at expense. And so they take the family to due process, at which point, if the family continues to want an IEE, they have to pay for it themselves. Well, isn't that a complicating mess then? If we have a certified school psychologist out there with no license, letting people know they're perfectly able and willing to do IEEs, whoever pays them. Well, I think that makes all of us all kinds of uncomfortable. So our district just made it a point that we only contracted with, or even had on our list of suggestions, individuals with a license.
Okay, what about Dr. Ostrom? How about Tempe?
I believe at this time, everyone on that list is licensed. I haven't looked at it in the last couple of months. I don't know if it changes. It can change periodically, but I believe at the last time I looked, they were all licensed individuals.
So we know that that was not true of another district, but we had a recent case. They had the non-licensed person evidently approved as a vendor to do an IEE. She was paid. So that's
and parents, not. And parents can choose who does that, so they don't have to use someone on the list.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, so how does this,
Linda? They show up with an evaluation that has been conducted already, and request that the district pay for it. And depending upon the process that's going on in the district, it may be considered an IEE and get paid for by the district. But it likely has already been paid for by the parents, and so we reimburse the parents. So there's also just kind of an interesting, we don't have a relationship with whoever that person is, really. We're just taking their report and considering their results.
But that's like an indirect IEE, but you would pay for someone that, if they brought the evaluation from a non-licensed person, the district might reimburse them.
Depending upon how they felt about whether they're only, it kind of depends. If they were willing to do an IEE, they might agree to pay this. They also might fight it. But they might agree.
Oh, anybody have comments on that? I never knew that.
I do. Regardless of the funding source, it's what the activity is designated, by the IRS is W-2, is there 1099? Is the person an employee or are they a contractor?
Well, they were an employee, and they were paid, the parents, and they were an employee either. So I don't even know. You didn't pay them with a 1099 or W-2, probably. Julene?
I think there has to be some record.
Yeah, but maybe how would you have paid them? He's asking, would they paid? You paid the parent, not the psychologist.
You have to report his income.
In our district, I do not remember an occasion in which we would have paid a parent after the fact. To do an IEE, there's a process that has to be followed. And there are certain requirements for that IEE, and those all have to be done in order for that person to be paid.
I'm just recalling one case. That's what I'm recalling. And it could have been messy. And I have to be honest, I don't remember whether the psychologist that the parents used was licensed or not. But it,
and mo-
it
and most districts, question,
oh, yeah, sorry. That it could have been someone non-licensed.
One, most districts have pretty strict requirements on what that IEE looks like. It has to resemble an evaluation that would be done within the school. So it has a pretty broad scope in terms of it has to have the same type of assessments so that it can be used in schools for decision making.
It's curious that if the school district would hire that psychologist to do the evaluation, that's an immediate conflict. The evaluator is supposed to be independent from the school district.
That's point.
Requesting the evaluation. Right. So you have an immediate conflict.
Some states that I listed there do specifically talk about IEEs in that list. And that's something I'm thinking about statutes or policy statements. So we had something for 7. So for 8, do you think we should specifically state that in a policy statement that IEE evaluations need to be completed by a licensed psychologist or not?
Excuse me, Linda, but I pulled up what the rule language says, and this is in quotes from the rule language. An evaluation conducted by a qualified evaluator who is not employed by the public education agency responsible for the education of the child in question is the definition of an IEE.
I think they qualify because it might be audiologist or speech pathologist to make it more general, right? Well, we could make a change to that if we wanted to in a policy statement or a revised statute.
I guess it was to the point of that they're not employed by, and it's the language that they're not employed by the public education.
May I ask what rule you're referring to, Dr. Bowen?
So it's 34 CFR 300.502.
Thank you.
State Board of Education, right, Kathy?
Yes, State Board of Education, yep.
So do you That's why I think, but I was responding to qualified, rather they didn't say certified school psychologist or licensed, I think to make it broad for other disabilities, you know. So do you think that this is something that we need to put in a statute or policy, that what we expect the qualifications of the IEE should be, or just leave it as a state education issue?
Dr. Katarina,
excuse me. Go ahead, John.
Thanks. I'm not there yet. And I'll tell you why. The demand is out there for qualified school psychologists. Okay. And I don't have a strong sense of what the common practice is, how prevalent what we're trying to regulate or what we're trying to common is. But I'd be reluctant to jump to restrictive language until I had a better sense about, so what is it working? Is it common practice? Do we have people with expertise that are doing this stuff? The demand is definitely there. So one approach would be, as I said before, to alter the language in the exemption licensure. I'm not saying we should or shouldn't, to include contracted people rather than, you know, taking a restrictive approach. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but taking a restrictive approach to limiting people that are out there that can do the work. And, you know, the reality, and anybody correct me if I got this wrong, the vast majority of school psychologists aren't docs. Yeah. They're EDSs, they're master level. Okay. They're doing the heavy lifting. So I think for me, it's more of a matter of inclusion and adjustment of statute rather than exclusion and more regulation. I mean, that's kind of where I'm at.
I completely agree. I mean, I think most school districts in the state of Arizona are contracting school psychologists for short-term leaves, long-term leaves, specialty areas like bilingual school psychologists. I think it is a common practice that would make sense to include that in statute if it currently isn't spelled out clearly enough.
Well, what I'm talking about, so just for the IEEs now. Not for the next one is about the contracting, but from what I heard, John, is that according to Dr. Robbins and Dr. Ostrom, and Dr. Robbins said she asked other lead psychologists that most of them only take licensed psychologists in IEE.
We do, but I will say to you, in acknowledgement of what Ramona said earlier, we're here in the Valley. We have a lot of options. And would it be wholly inappropriate for a school in Northern Arizona to contact their neighboring school district and ask to contract with one of their school psychologists, who's a certified school psychologist and perfectly capable of doing a fine IEE? Would that be, we would hate for that in a statutory way to be inappropriate, I think. But I think we have to look at all of the things that could happen. Now we chose licensed psychologists because it's the safest way to go. And that's why we did it, I think. But I would hate to put that in statute and have that have to be how everyone in the state has to behave when maybe there are solutions to our shortages in other places.
Yeah, it was not in every one of the other states, but there were some that had that. So we have the choice to leave it as it is, to make that recommendation, or just to make it so more inclusive, and silent on that issue, I think, you know, whatever you want. So you're thinking just make it, leave it silent is what sounds like.
Could I just add one other thing? So what I look at is that statement about qualified evaluator, when I look at the language from the Arizona Department of Education, and you had it in some of the materials that you provided to all of us too, there are clear delineations of who is listed as qualified evaluators for various categories of eligibility. I mean, to your point about speech language pathologists and audiologists, but also where it designates certified school psychologists.
Please read that. Yes.
For emotional disability and for other health impairment now, certified school psychologists are listed as the definition of a qualified evaluator for those specific areas of eligibility.
Okay, so that's already in their in their
center? In the Arizona Department of Education, yes.
So you think it would be wise as a group to leave that, not touch that then, since they've already spoken to that and not comment one way or the other from our board? Yes?
Is that? I think they're stepping on toes and we need to be careful because we have a body that is regulating school psychologists and we need to respect the, you know, it's a state appointed body. They are very much, they function like our board. They're, you know, a governor appointed board that regulates the profession. So.
Okay. So that we'll say for age, we're not going to make a statement on that.
The description that Kathy read is also kind of mirrored in the IDEA mandate, the federal mandate calls people qualified examiners and doesn't delineate each of the areas, but it doesn't say a thing about licensure. So I think this puts us in safe territory the way we have
it. So then number nine, oh, sorry, any other thing?
No, I just was going to voice my, my thought on this. As a school psychologist, I think the concern is unprepared or untrained, less trained licensed psychologist coming into school and providing independent evaluations. To me, that's another concern from different perspectives. So I just want to throw that out, that it is just not licensure issue here.
I think that Dr. Robbins has a good point. She might want to mention how she handled that. So do you want to tell them how you sent out what they needed to include in every evaluation?
Yeah, and I think Jennifer's district does the same. We came up with exactly what an IEE should look like and all of the components, including the educational context, so that in order to do an IEE for our district, you needed to make sure that you made some connections with school people. And each of the components of one of our reports had to be mirrored in the IEE. And occasionally we would get some, just as you're absolutely acknowledging, Gina, that's exactly what we saw, were some licensed psychologists, nice, lovely reports that were clinical and did not illuminate our situation at all. And so we would ask them to go back and clarify, rescore, choose another measure, come to the school, because we needed to have the questions answered that needed to be answered from an IEE, not just an outside evaluation. That was cursory. So
I think that was a great way to handle it.
We were kind of snotty about it.
All right. Point nine. This is where we're talking about the contract, non-licensed certified school psychologist. This is where you've been coming in. Up to. I knew this would be a big thing, so I put that last. Should we have these companies that have certified school psychologists that lend them out to schools when people are on leave or when they have a certain expertise or just because they couldn't hire enough people? So what do you, and this is referred to in many of the other states, by the way, that they do allow it. So what about you all? What do you think? This is point nine. Well, should we have these educational sort of, you know, agencies? Go ahead, Dr. Millett.
So there's two ways I look at this. You know, when you have, say, somebody, you know, and we have some big organizations that do this kind of work. You know, they have actually many credentials. They have speech pathologists. I know of several consortiums up here, or even sometimes an independent psychologist who may secure contracts from several schools. You know, somebody has to write those bids, and get the contracts, and then they hire certified. But the distinction in either, whether it's an agency or an independent person, from my knowledge, is they're hiring the certified school psychologist who's going out to the schools. They're not co-signing the report. So the situation is still the same. Well, I guess it's slightly, I mean, so they're providing the services in the schools based on their certification as a school psychologist. And again, the distinction is they're not setting up a private practice. They're providing the evaluations in the school. That's the most common way most of the reservation schools are served. You know, it's these consortiums that hire many psychologists, some licensed, but some certified, who then go out to the schools. And the service is, again, only done in the schools. You know, the child is tested in the school. The report is provided to the school. The payment in those cases happens to the contractor or the agency who then pays the school psychologist.
So do you think that the person that owns this agency, do they have to be a licensed psychologist? Because they, in a way, are a private practice. The people are working for them, but the ones that own it, are they considered to be, that they need to be licensed?
They're not signing off on the reports. All they're doing is securing the contracts. So it could be a layperson off the street, you know. Most cases, they're not, because chances are if the person walks out and then they have to go complete the contract. So they have a vest, you know, once they've signed the contract, they can leave a school district high and dry. So in most cases, they have the credentials to jump in, you know, and cover those services.
Yeah.
So let me just read this on the list I gave you, the Connecticut law. It has it in the law. A school psychologist who is certified by the Department of Ed may provide school psychological services to a school district on a contractual basis for the purpose of specialized services not available within the school district. Bilingual eval, neuropsychological eval, program planning for a child with autism, clinical supervision, or to provide coverage for leave of absence. So, I mean, they have this in their law. Since it sounded like most of you agree that this is okay, should we put it in our law?
I don't agree it's okay, Dr.
Okay, let me hear that.
Good. Okay. Let me add a wrinkle here, and I'm trying not to get too draconian about it, but let's say you have a licensed psychologist who has a firm, and he or she employs certified school psychologists, okay? And to expand the scenario, and the CEO, who's the licensed psychologist, says, these are school psychologists under my supervision, or whatever the term is, then I think the board certainly has jurisdiction, and all the rules that apply to supervision and all of that would apply.
Like psychometrists, like they would be like psychometrists.
Whatever they are, if the psychologist says something like supervising, you know, I'm consulting with, doing something with them, then that psychologist can be held accountable. But again, I think what it comes back to is what do you call the activity from a reimbursement standpoint? Are they contracted? Are they employees? I can't be any more articulate than that, but I think it always comes back to that. And right now we have no permission in the exemption statute for anything but employee.
That's why I think, you know, we could change that, or like in the way Connecticut has, and say that specifically is one option. Yeah. So you're saying you would not be comfortable with these contracting services. Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is that there's no permission in statute to do that.
Right. I'm saying we could change that.
You could. I don't have extensive knowledge of colleagues more than me about the common practice. Okay. How much of this is really going on? Are we making too much out of one or two cases? I don't know. But definitely, my perception is that there is a need, there's demand out there, there's expertise out there. So what's the common practice? I mean, are consumers going to embrace this, or are they going to say, no, you know, we want to go with the big deal licensed people, and we don't feel comfortable, you know, with certified people? I don't think that'll happen. But in any case, okay, I'll stop talking. I don't know if I can say much more about that.
Well, you know, the experience that I've had, and I think some other districts have had as well, is that we do use these contract companies. And when we hire one of their people, they come to the school district and they, in all intents and purposes, are our employee. They have to follow our procedures. They have an office in our schools. They come and we're paying for their time of day, not just evaluation by evaluation. They are our contracted employee from one day a week to 5 days a week. And the supervision is then ours to say, you can stay, you can go. We pay the contracting company. They don't usually get benefits from us of any sort. And they just get whatever their contract person pays them. But in terms of their function, they function as one of our contracted.
Do you tell them what procedures to use? What absolutely. Tests, how to do,
yes.
Do it? Yes. Now that, yes. that crosses over into employee status.
Uh-huh.
A contractor, as I understand it, you can set the broad parameters, but the procedure, the tests, all of that is at the discretion of the evaluator. But then you raise an issue about who do you answer to? Mm-hmm. For instance, a licensed psychologist, I can contract with you and you can't ask me to do anything below the standard of care. You can add on additional things as long as they're not unprofessional. Mm-hmm. But if I say, well, I'm going to listen to you, I got to answer to my board, not you, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I'm getting at is that the point I want to make is that if you're dictating, you're suggesting, if you're requiring, like you're going to do it this way, these are the tests you're going to use, this is how we want you to write it up. That is now morphing into an employee status.
And the contracted person has every ability to say, you know what, I don't agree with your procedures,
yeah.
but then we don't agree to work together. You know, that's the way yeah. it is.
If they act, again, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but if they act west yeah. to doing what you're asking to do in order to keep the contract, I mean, I get that. Now it raises another issue about employee contracted. It's like a hybrid almost now. Whereas as a contractor, if I come into your school district, you're not going to tell me. You can tell me what you expect and what you're looking for, but you're not going to tell me what tests to give, how to administer, how to interpret them. That's my domain. I'm a contractor. I'm not an employee.
Well, I think district.
Even a sort of person that's employed could do that.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I don't know that. We have a level of ethical responsibility to the psychologists in our own district to make sure that we are using procedures and allowing school psychologists to make their own decisions about which tests they're going to give in a situation. And it, you know, there's a appropriate school psych practice and that's what we use. But we certainly do anticipate that if our district uses a multi-tiered systems of support to help a team try to problem solve with a student, that contracted psychologist will become informed about what that is and be part of that process if that's what all of the school psychologists in our district are doing.
Yeah.
So we'll anticipate those pieces, but I don't know that we nitpick on testing.
And in fairness to school psychologists, they can do much more than child study individual evaluations. Sure. They become part of the system. They can deal with teachers. They can deal with administration. They can deal with team building, a lot of things. The school psychologists today are broadly trained generally. And then, again, I don't want to sound like I'm advocating for school psychology, but I am. I think oftentimes they're the best people in place to do that kind of work, but I'll stop.
And our contracted school psychologists, they get badges, they use our testing equipment, they use our scoring software. The teachers in the schools would not know the difference between a contracted school psychologist mm-hmm. and a direct hire school psychologist.
Do you know, Dr. Ostrom, in one of the minutes, there was a question by a board member asked, do these contracted people use the school district materials?
Yes.
And maybe John or Ramona remember, why did that come up as an issue? Was that a problem?
I don't recall. Linda.
Okay.
I can answer that question. And, you know, I have a lot of personal knowledge, so I'm using that. Some school districts are so small, they don't have the equipment. And some school districts are large enough that they provide the testing equipment. And Kathy is way more experienced than I am. Is that true, Kathy?
No, my question was, why did was the board member that asked why
it goes back to that was trying to make a difference?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kathy was
going
to say something.
I'm just going to concur with what you were saying, Ramona. I mean, very small districts, when they only are, especially charter schools or really small districts in rural areas, may only have a few avowals per year. And so that's when the contracting company may have the kids. They may help, have the district then charge for the protocols or some other kind of components with that. But as everyone else is saying here, they are following the procedures that that school has set up that might be using MTSS data or other kinds of data that have been put in place to help with determining eligibility. But it's all within the scope of what school psychologists do.
No, the question really was not, do we help out these poor districts? But I think when they asked the question in the minutes, it was like, why should the districts be providing materials to these outside contractors? It was sort of like they asked that one question and there was no follow-up. But if they're independent, should the district be giving the materials?
I don't think we need to debate that question. If the district is going to provide materials, great. If they're not and they don't
have it. I think it goes to whether they're independent or not.
Well, these are expensive kits and tests, and sometimes the district wants them to do a specific type of test. So it's all across the board. Really, I was just thinking as we're going through this whole thing, this question has come up in the 16 years I've been on the board several times, many, many times. I think we do need to expand the statute language to cover the fact that if a psychologist is contracted either through a third party or directly by the school district, and they're providing a service for the school, providing a service that is requested for the school, then, and they are certified by the Arizona Department of Education, they fall under that exemption.
I still think we got to look at that for versus in.
But that would be part of the language change, because we've debated this so many times.
I think we do need to make a change. I agree.
Yeah, definitely. We need to make a change. We have a strong high need. We do not have licensed psychologists who are qualified to actually provide those services, because they don't get the same training that a school psychologist, an EDS or master's level school psychologist, is getting to do that kind. As Gina was talking about, we have licensed psychologists that are probably sometimes practicing outside their competency area by doing those evaluations. Right. And that can be regulated by a board, because you shouldn't, like forensics, Dr. DeBacco is very well versed with people practicing forensic psychology who don't have that training in forensics. Similarly, but we need to address the issue of people who are employed by school districts, whether do a W-2 or a 1099, and providing that. So, and then deal with people who are practicing outside their scope of practicing and setting up a private practice. That's a whole different matter. And we have regulations to address that.
See, because that's why I'm concerned about the word for, because they could say, well, I'm an independent practice, but I'm doing this for the school. I'm helping the school. So I do think we need to write up possible statutes or wording, and then maybe by next meeting we could share how we each write it up, looking at maybe some of the other states. Maybe each of us could try a way to write that up to include the IE, not the IE, but the contract psychologist.
So let me say, devil's advocate here. For what if I am a person who's a qualified school psychologist, Kathy's licensed, she's about to retire. But what if you had a certified school psychologist about to retire and all they do is independent educational evaluation? And so school districts know that that's what they do. They've got 35 years. And so they are hired by school districts, or people are referring them. Are they qualified? Yes.
That's a good question, because if they are doing that, they are in private practice then. And they're not licensed.
Yeah, only doing it in schools as part of the independent education. I don't know. I don't understand. Maybe I'll let the school psychologist talk about that, the IEEs.
So. I'm really struggling to see why we want to regulate this piece.
Because it's come up so many times. And I think that if we agree with these contracting people and we put that in the statute that we're allowed to have contracted schools, like college, it's not going to come up as an issue of is this person practicing or not, because it's come up for 15 years.
Because to me, this is a school-based practice and this is a purview of ADE. That's how I feel. I feel like I'm missing something.
But if they have the independent, if they're doing it independently, they're performing the functions of an independent licensed psychologist. And they're not allowed to unless they are licensed by the board. Every one of these states, I think all but maybe not everyone, maybe there were six or some, all say they cannot practice independently. Most of these say that. So it does not allow for practice in any other arena than schools. Another one say cannot practice independently. So if they're having this practice, even that they are contracting by themselves, what we'd have to decide is that independent practice. That's the question. I don't know, but they do. But many of them make the exemption for the contracted companies. So that's why I thought we could put that in the law.
If we are going to develop language to include contracting, I liked how Dr. Malat just made it very general about providing services for the school rather than parsing out for different certain occasions, because there can be lots of different reasons why a school is contracting out a school psychologist. Mm-hmm. So just keeping it simple, I think, would be best.
But I agree, but then I also want to make it so it can't be exploited and say, well, I'm doing it for the school, you know, and really not being, it really is then a cover for a private practice. That's why I thought if we look at different languages from the other states or come together next time and go through that specifically, you know, I think it's going to take time to do it exactly right legally. That's why. And Jolene, did you have a question?
No. Oh, I have my foot firmly on a banana peel about this. I have to say. Well, speaking from what Gina pointed out and what Jen did as well, I would any day and Sunday take Jennifer Ostrom's top school psychologists to invite them into my district to do an IEE that I know will have all the contextual pieces that we need to have in an educational eval. Then I might go out and hand them our list of licensed psychologists, some of which.
But Jolene, this experience. Is not the IEE. We agree that we're going to make maybe no statement on the IEE.
Okay, good.
Because this is the next one, like the one agencies, the contracting agencies.
Oh, I think they should fall under the contracted, whether it's through an agency or directly contracted.
But I think we should put that something in the law is what I'm saying about that, accepting that, that we accept that. They're not violating the licensing law by doing that.
Well, I know for a fact that there are some, or have heard, and I don't know names, of a couple of individuals who are out there doing exactly that. They don't want to work for a school district, so they're out there just kind of marketing themselves as people who will come in and do IEEs. And so, yes, that's where John's question of who are they working for? Who's paying them? Are they working for a school district? If it's an independent educational eval, they're not working in the school system. Then I think that that's skidding on thin ice about whether they're in private practice or not. They kind of are. On the other hand, could they be doing some pretty darn good evals because they're qualified evaluators under the law? They are. That's where the banana peel comes in, you guys.
So this is back to, point eight. That's why I was saying we have really mixed views then. Should we leave it alone? That's why I thought maybe we'd leave it alone because it's too, we don't have a consensus here. But nine, I thought we did agree, many of us agree that we could accept these agencies. Mm-hmm. The point where Ramona brought up is what if it's not a contracting agency, but just one person that just says, I want to do it myself. I don't want to be contracted with an agency. Then is that okay?
But they're being contracted by the school district. So that's, yes. So, I mean, I think that's fine. They have put in a bid, got it the bid accepted by a school district, and they're providing that services for the school district. It goes back to how we define who's an employee. I had a question for Ms. Galvin. Yes. A statute change, you know, can take 3 years. You know, we've missed the boat this year. What do we do? Those
substantive policy.
Where we define what an employee is, because our statute says an employee, and maybe at a future point.
So a substantive policy statement may be used to inform the public how the board or an agency interprets its statutes. So it would seem that it would be appropriate, or at least possible, to use a substantive policy statement to say that, you know, as it relates to 32.2075A, the board interprets employed by to include those who are, you know, paid through a W-2 and those who receive a 1099, those who contract with an outside agency where a number of, you know, certified school psychologists are employed. So you could use that, a substantive policy statement, to bridge the gap until you get a statutory change.
That's what I was thinking we might want to do with any of these issues. That's why I brought up a slew of them. So what do you think about my idea that we try to, each of us try to write a little bit of the policy and hash that out next time? What we think might be an appropriate few sentences?
I think maybe we could start with one rather than each of us coming, and then we could all wordsmith it as a group.
What might, if I may, because a lot of you may not and have experience with substantive policy statements, and why would you? But I could help Heidi draft one. I'm drafting Heidi to draft a substantive policy statement, and then you all could review it and edit it. And then that would probably be easier.
I see a lot of heads nodding. I think we all agree. That would be wonderful. Okay, let's quickly, yes, go ahead, Heidi.
What would be ideal, I think, would be for the general focus or the general intent be adopted in a formal motion, and then Ms. Galvin and I will work her magic from that point.
So I can't make the motion, right? Somebody else has to.
You can make the motion, but the motion would be very simple: to direct staff to draft a substantive policy statement addressing the committee's concerns in 32.2075A1, particularly defining how the committee or the board would interpret employee.
Okay, so you said it beautifully. I make that motion as expressed by Ms. Galvin. Any second?
I'll second.
Any, what's the vote on this? Any ayes?
Aye.
Any negative? Any
no? But
nays? Okay.
Just point of clarification that ultimately that statement has to go to the board for approval.
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is just a recommendation coming out of this committee, and it will go to the full board for approval.
I just want to get through this quickly. Number 10. I thought this might be important. We did have this is how does the how do we communicate to the Department of Ed concerns that we might have, that people, we think maybe somebody, a school psychologist setting up an actual private practice, let's say, like, and how do we communicate that to the Department of Ed, who is their regulatory group? And I did have Ms. Michelson checked, and there have been only two people that have come to our board that for concerns. And then I don't know how many, I think you told me, Julene, there were very few that went to the State Department of Ed, and they were mostly for failure to report sexual abuse.
That was exactly what, at least what the two investigative individuals that Jennifer and I had a chance to meet with.
But I don't know if they said, Julene, there were fairly few. I think that they just told us at the time there were the two that were being investigated.
Actually, my note said, I think that it was that there have been two psychologists that have had their certificates removed, and that's what it was removed for. They didn't give us the number of investigations that psychologists were involved in.
No, the two I referred to, the one that became for our board, the two that I was talking about were in front of our board. Okay,
yeah, go ahead. When Julian and I met, they had said two psychologists lost their certification in the last 8 months. So I don't know how many, you know, in the last 20 years, but.
So do you think, I mean, the question is, if we see things that we're concerned about as school psychologists functioning in a way that we think goes against, the board comes up with is against our law, our statutes, who do we tell? How do we contact the Department of Ed? What do we do?
There is a chief investigator, and we have those names in the notes that Julian submitted, correct?
I think Ms. Michelson is aware of this because we report our complaints to many boards. If we have somebody who's a psychologist and a nurse, we report to the nursing board. Counselors come up frequently in our board and we report it to the counseling board of behavioral health exam. So we have a process already in place.
Oh, I didn't know. Is there any other comment on that point 10? Okay. And then point 11, discussion and consideration, possible action on concerning the research completed or in process. Do you have, so I did a few things looking up NASP and Heidi and everybody and Jennifer. Do we think there's any other research we need to obtain? I thought what I would say is maybe some of the policy statements from other states that, okay, you know, but otherwise, is there anything else that you think we need to?
Linda, y'all are probably aware of this. The November 2020 School Psychology Journal, Division of School Psychology 16, it does a, it's going to be backwards.
I only get it online. Oh.
Yeah, it's an excellent job in terms of the history of school psychology, you know, desired, the actual movement, expansion of the school psychological practice, et cetera. I think it's very valuable. I hesitated to send it to Heidi. I don't want to bury her with stuff, but I think this might be helpful if people are interested.
Okay.
Did you all get Division 16? No?
Yeah, I do get it. I did get that, actually, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Dr. DeFalco, do you happen to know if there's a digital copy of that material? It may be something that you have access to as a member, you know, behind some login credentials. Great.
Yeah. Linda, do you get it digitally?
No, now I don't know. I think when you held it up, it looks like I got it. Yes.
Can you give us the issue and volume?
I can look up and then get the PDF.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other things that, for point 11 that we need to know?
Madam Chair, I just want to maybe comment. I am not sure that other states have the latitude to issue substantive policy statements that, you know, the way that Arizona does. We're specifically authorized to do so in the Arizona revised statutes, but I will sort of ask for any sort of, you know, general policies or of that nature. What we find may not be entirely congruent with our substantive policy statements, just by way of.
You might find maybe some of that we found in the NASP document. You might find some laws or statutes maybe, and then we can use that to formulate the policy statement maybe. All right, anything else on 11? No. 12, other resources or experts we need to bring in?
Dr. Katarina, you've done an excellent job researching everything, so I think we have you're the resource that you
can get. Any other experts? Okay, 13, we want a future meeting. I think we definitely need one, so when was, are you thinking about 3 weeks or?
Yeah, I think we need to give both Ms. Galvin and Ms. Packenden some time to work on it.
I was thinking, 3 or 4 weeks.
I don't know, that's.
Because I was wondering about for the academics as the school year is ending. And
maybe Ms. Packenden could send out a doodle poll.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we wait?
That's what I think, but how long a time frame? You know, you think 3, 4, 5 weeks? That's, Because I don't want her to send out every day. It's like time frame.
You'll want to work on it some, and then when you know you're getting close, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before that, send out a doodle poll. Would that work better? Because I know, you know, Ms. Galvin serves several boards, not just our board, and so I just want to be respectful of your time.
Well, yes. What about Kathy or Ms. Dr. Yoon? Are you going to be out of town because or even Jolene or Jennifer, because your year will end? Do you plan to leave? Or?
I'm doing some traveling, but soon as opposed to later, so I'll be back.
And then any agenda? One agenda item I have for the next meeting would be to look at the policy statement. And anything else that you want to put on the agenda for next time?
Dr. Catarino, as I'm saying this, I think it's a good idea not to get too deep into it, but we had raised issues about neuropsychs using psychometrists.
Yeah.
My suggestion is table that baby for a while until we get through this one.
Oh, yeah. No, that we're not going to cover that. That's enough for me.
And that would be outside the purview of this committee, Dr. DeBacco. That would be maybe. Yes.
No, I saw that in some of the minutes. I know that is another issue, but that's.
I think we need to bring neuropsychologists on board so they can.
Well, let them do their own. Go on their own committee. Okay, do that. And then what about this call for the public? Do they. What do you want to tell me about that, Ms. Pakiman? What do we do there?
Yes, Madam Chair. I had anticipated that because this is a public meeting and there were members of the public here at the previous meeting that maybe they would attend and wish to speak, but I don't see anyone here. So if there's no one to speak, then we can just move on.
So do you think that, and also at the next meeting, should we invite the public?
Is always invited at a public meeting.
That's what I thought you meant, public for the next meeting, but you meant for this meeting. Okay, are there any other points?
Maybe needs to be early on the
agenda. Yes, Dr. June?
There are 12 articles in that issue. Do you want all of them?
Send the table of contents. Maybe.
Okay, all right, I'll do that. All right.
And then they could pick which ones they want.
Yeah. Just a comment, Madam Chair.
Yes.
It'd be nice to get somebody from the Department of Education involved in this.
Well, I think we tried, right? We talked about this. And what happened? You mentioned a name, and then Jennifer, you knew someone, right?
I was thinking Tracy, and I can never pronounce her last name, from Arizona Department of Education, who is a school psychologist.
What happened with that? I thought we were going to invite them.
Tracy met with us, with the two gentlemen from the investigative unit. And in our invitation to them, they said, yeah, we're going to prefer not to be part of that conversation. So I don't know that we'll twist anyone's arm into that. And they didn't say a whole lot more. They just stopped us at the door.
Well, the only thing there we would have, now we know how to contact them. And then the other part was what Kathy Bohan read, and then we're not touching that. We're not going against that in any way. So might be okay. All right. I mean, we agreed to just leave that term qualified person to do the evaluation. So I don't know. Well, they at the end, when we're all done, maybe. But they can, they're part of the public. We could invite them if they want to come. And they probably would choose not to based on what you said.
We can always notice them and just inform them about the meetings.
Absolutely.
And indicate that they're always welcome.
Right. Anything else today? Well, I want to thank you, first of all, for moving it up an hour and for appreciate everyone's interest and participation and again, thank you to the staff. So, we'll close for today then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.